Bienvenue sur Radio Créum. Welcome to Radio Créum. This is a special recording of the Breaking the Silence Conference on the Indian Residential Schools Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada that took place at the University of Montreal on September 26th and 27th in 2008. You will now hear part 4 of the recording, which features the second panel, chaired by Pierre Noreau, on the ethical challenges of reconciliation with Christian Nadeau, Val Napoleon and Dale Turner.
Bon début d'après-midi à tous. Mon nom est Pierre Noreau. Je suis chercheur au Centre de recherche en droit public et directeur scientifique du projet Peuples autochtones et gouvernance. Je suis très heureux aujourd'hui de présider la rencontre, le panel, en fait, qui a été organisé dans le cadre de ce colloque-ci sur le thème des Ethical Challenges of Reconciliation. And we receive today three famous scholars who can speak of this specific topic. Val Napoleon, qui nous vient de l'Université d'Alberta, de la Faculté de droit. Christian Nadeau, du département de philosophie de l'Université de Montréal, et Dale Turner, du Government and Native American Studies de l'Université Dartmouth. Fait que je veux les remercier d'avoir accepté de participer à cet atelier, et puis je les invite à venir présenter chacun leur point de vue là-dessus, suite à quoi on pourra prendre les questions que vous aurez à poser et on continuera le dialogue entrepris ce matin. Alors, je veux d'abord céder la parole à Christian Nadeau du département de philosophie de l'Université de Montréal, que je remercie encore d'être ici.
Alors, j'ai su ce matin seulement que nous pourrions présenter nos textes en français, donc le mien est en anglais. Ce que je vais faire, c'est comme mon anglais est très exécrable et que vous risquez d'entendre plutôt du mandarin. Je vais lire mon texte en anglais, je m'excuse pour la lecture, et ensuite, par contre, je vais faire un petit résumé en français, et pour la période des questions, si ça ne vous gêne pas, puisque nous avons le service de traduction, donc je vais répondre aux questions en français. We are here together to discuss the ethical challenge of reconciliation. But many of us should first consider the question, is reconciliation possible at all? What is it that we want in reconciliation? Is it an empty word? Or do we have real expectations when we ask for reconciliation? But we must also presuppose that there is a kind of culpability or at least a responsibility of an agent toward another one. And if there is a culpability, why should we try to reconciliate the victim and the wrongdoers and the offenders? Isn't it a lack of justice if, with reconciliation, we ask something of the victim we don't ask from the offenders? In the philosophical literature, the problem of punishment divides two schools of thought, and very roughly, the first one seems to think that punishment is required in order to make justice. A criminal or a wrongdoer deserves a punishment because of what he did in the past. The second one, which we could call restorative justice, which has inspired most of the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, says that the stakeholders to some offense must get together and decide what has to be done in its aftermath. Rather than victim and offender being taken up by a bureaucracy that has its own way of dealing with the problem or its own preoccupation, victims and wrongdoers are able to keep themselves at the center of the history. In this paper, I am concerned with the proper role of apology in Truth and Reconciliation Commission especially in the case of Indian residential schools. I see apology as a part of the recognition of the wrong that was done to Aboriginal people in the past. But apology is nothing without a kind of punitive response to the wrongdoing. So what I want to present here is a mixed strategy of punishment between retributive justice and restorative justice. I am not sure that we should always take that road. I really do think that restorative justice is the best system that we have in most of the occasion. But here, we should take into account that the wrongdoers are the ones who are supposed, or were supposed, to make justice at the beginning of the story. Because we are talking here of the state or political authorities, and that's a very specific problem we're talking about. We're not talking about individuals. We're talking about institutions. And that's why I don't think reconciliation is possible if it's a way of forgetting the past, and that's why we need, in order to have an appropriate punitive response to the wrongdoing, to see the ritual of apology as a complex one, where the search for the truth could lead us to sanction and reconciliation. What I keep from what we could call the retributive tradition of criminal justice is the idea that, in a sense, we have a special obligation towards wrongdoers, especially if those wrongdoers were the guardians of the supreme authority of the state. But what is the wrong or the offense in this case? When a bad guy kills an honest person, we see without any doubt that a crime has been done. But what is the crime in putting a couple of hundred of children in residential school, especially when the general idea was to do that for their own good? Aboriginal children were the only children in Canadian history who, over an extended period of time, were statutorily designed to live in institutions primarily because of their race. Large numbers of school-age Aboriginal children, at times 1 to 1/3 of them, were sent to residential schools. In some communities, this continued for decades and affected many generations. It was thought that forcibly removing First Nation children from their homes and putting them in residential school was the quickest way to civilize the First Nation. First Nations were seen as barbaric, and in many cases, the children were forbidden to speak their own language. So this is a very specious racial crime, a crime perpetrated for a very strange idea of what should be our nation and the future of Indians of Canada, in Canada. Indeed, we should talk here of major human rights violation. So, at least for this case, or for a similar situation, but at least for this case, I will depart from those who think of restorative justice as being a non-punitive response to crime. But I'm not sympathetic to the idea that restorative justice should be part and only be part of a state system of crime. I do think that a form of community justice is still very important, even if we are dealing with what we could call state crime. It is true, the collective censure of wrongdoing is a necessary action of the state, and we should resist the view on which crimes are seen as private conflict. But community justice should play a very important role in the criminal justice system, and I argue that their first role is to establish the conditions of the public excuses. But the victims must be beforehand ensured that this right or this ritual of public excuse do not prevent legal pursuits. The main idea here is to see the apology ritual not as something that will dismiss punishment, but as a symbolic ritual of recognition of the wrongdoing, which will lead the community to the truth and to an appropriate response to the crime. An important part of this symbolic ritual of recognition of the wrongdoing is what we could call the moral communication between the stakeholders. For something as recent and as tragic as the case of Indian residential schools, we could assume that there was, and maybe there still is, a disagreement about whether the action committed by the state's authorities were permissible or not. The disagreement will be about the moral and the legal permissibility of this action committed in the past. Strangely, this disagreement could be the basis of the reconciliation and the apology ritual. This could be possible because disagreement is the starting of a dialogue between the parties. Maybe one could think that, doing so, we are giving too much importance or credibility to the wrongdoers. But I think, and not enough to the victims, but I think this is the best way to reconcile the idea of reconciliation and the necessity of justice. Engaging wrongdoers, even if we are talking about state authorities, has a number of virtues. It demonstrates respect for the offender as a moral agent. It does not treat him as an agent to be controlled. It treats him as someone who has a conscience and who can be expected to respond. The problem here is that we're not only talking about human agents, but about institutions. How could we expect institutions to respond when those institutions are not made of flesh and blood? This is where the community system is very important. The community system is the appropriate collective agent to establish a dialogue with the state. The type of interaction with the wrongdoer that I am thinking about is that in which the parties reason together about whether the wrongdoer was right to act as he did, and in which they attempt to get the wrongdoer to understand and accept that what he did was wrong. Through collective discussion, the parties aim the wrongdoer to recognize not only what was done, but why it was wrong. This should lead parties to see what could be done to prevent future harm. Furthermore, this can be seen as invoking some conception of responsibility. We could talk of a normative competence, or the capacity to understand and respond appropriately to moral reasons. This, in my view, is what is necessary in order to have apologies, by which I mean both punitive response to wrongdoing and reconciliation. In my perspective, financial settlement, if crucial, is not enough. If the moral dialogue between the parties is a real one, which we could doubt, but we have no choice to hope for a moral dialogue between the parties, then we could identify what constitutes the continuation of the wrongs the state committed in the past. So in my view, a real punitive response to wrongdoing is something that will engage the wrongdoer not to act anymore in the same way afterwards. In my view, we should think of a punitive response as a way to engage the wrongdoers in a reparation process that will prevent future harm. I know it's almost impossible to require something from the Harper government. Legally, apologize and financial compensation could be enough, given the fact that the harm was done in the past, and one could think that there is no reason to prevent a similar wrong in the future. But in the case of the state, the government is still in the same situation of power. By different means, even after official apologies and financial settlement, the actual government is still insulting and shaming Canadian native people. Exactly 1 year ago, as I am sure everyone remembers, conservative government vote against the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People. Canada was one of the four countries to oppose the declaration that passed, 143 in favor, 4 opposed to it, Canada, New Zealand, United States, Australia, and 11 countries abstaining. I don't want to compare this kind of injustice, not signing the declaration, to what was done against young children in residential schools. What I am trying to say here is that if we think of apologies, not only in terms of reconciliation, but also in terms of sanction, on a case like this one, which involves state authorities, the sanction must be talked as constraint and obligation. And for the moment, it's difficult to see a better protection against possible future harm against native people than this declaration. One could say that I'm mixing two different problems, but if apologies are not only formal ritual of reconciliation, but true commitment, then we should seek not only to fix past injustice, but also to prevent future ones. Alors, in a nutshell, what I wanted to say is no reconciliation is possible without obligation. Et dans le texte, ce que j'ai essayé de montrer, en fait, c'est qu'un des graves problèmes, me semble-t-il, c'est que même si nous voulons éviter une réconciliation qui fera en sorte que nous pourrions mettre de côté les torts du passé, ou tout simplement les mettre dans une case, nous avons pardonné, donc maintenant nous pouvons oublier tout ça, il ne peut pas y avoir de réconciliation possible sans qu'il y ait engagement de la part de ceux qui ont commis les offenses, et cet engagement, dans le cas d'un agent étatique, dans le cas d'une organisation, comme d'une institution comme celle de l'État, elle doit se traduire par des engagements qui ne se vérifient pas simplement par rapport au passé, mais aussi qui le contraignent par rapport à ce qu'il peut faire pour l'avenir. Autrement dit, il faut des contre-pouvoirs pour éviter des abus semblables ou des abus qui pourraient rappeler les abus qui ont été faits par le passé. Voilà, merci.
Alors, merci beaucoup, Christian Nadeau. Et puis, ça nous amène à notre deuxième intervention, celle de Val Napoléon, de la Faculté de droit de l'Université de l'Alberta, que je remercie d'avoir fait tout le voyage pour venir ici, qui est membre d'une équipe sur laquelle je suis aussi et puis pour laquelle j'ai beaucoup d'estime. Alors, je me donne la peine de souligner particulièrement sa présence. Je suis heureux de voir qu'elle est ici aujourd'hui. Merci. Alors, Val.
We can see from the conversations that we've had so far that the terms truth and reconciliation are loaded with all of the kinds of hopes and expectations that we bring to them. And there are a whole range of really interesting ethical considerations that are a part of considering how the Truth and Reconciliation Commission might work and the kinds of things that they might take into account. I want to focus on just a few of these. My overall concern is that what we've been calling the healing journey in many of the communities be politicized. My other concerns derive from the need to politicize healing, and they relate to issues of power, agency, citizenship, responsibility, and intellectual capacity. Underlying the kinds of expectations that we bring to something like a Truth and Reconciliation Commission are our assumptions about health, about healing, about people and communities, about culture and about change, as well as about the past and the future. To explain a little bit about my approach to this topic, I draw on the work of Native American scholar Joseph Gaughan. Basically, what Gaughan argues is that we must critically examine our assumptions about who is being healed, why they are being healed, how they are being healed, as well as what healing is. In his work, Gaughan worked with a community in northern Canada, and it was in an Aboriginal community. And there were three assumptions that underlie the work that took place in that lodge. And these assumptions are pervasive through the healing discourse. One is that Aboriginal people have been burdened by colonial history. As a consequence, we experience the dysfunctions and addictions. That's how it's manifested. And in order to unburden ourselves, we must talk about these experiences. So the talk is therapy. According to Gonn, the therapeutic model that's currently widely in place is that in that model, the concept of the self that is being healed, is that of a Western self, not of an Aboriginal self, or in the case that he was working with, a Cree self. So that is culturally shaped ways of seeing the world, doing in the world, and being in the world did not reflect Cree society. And emotion, in the understanding of emotion in that therapeutic model, was also from a Western perspective, not from a Cree perspective. So what Gonn concluded is that part of what we need to look at in the work that's going on with healing is that perhaps the self has become the new site of colonization through the importation of concepts of self and emotion. So how does this translate into ethical challenges for the Commission? I think that these are closely related topics that I'll speak to. And the first is about that concept of self. From my perspective, the self is a cultural concept. The way we respond emotionally and the way we understand emotion are also cultural. And when I say culture, I talk in terms of the fullest possible sense of understanding that, so that the self as part of a political, economic, legal, and social environment within our respective societies. An ethical challenge before the Commission concerns the importance of not assuming that there's a universal Aboriginal person and not imposing one cultural self onto others. While there are obvious similarities between our societies, there are also major differences that derive from our cosmologies, from our ontologies, those ways of being and doing and existing in the universe. For example, the Dunizá in northeast British Columbia has a different concept of self from that of the Gik'san in southern or mid-British Columbia. The Gik'san self is competitive, collaborative. There is a part of a complex matrilineal kinship network. A Dunizá self is relationally autonomous, independent, and part of fluid kinship relationships. Appreciating the differences as well as the similarities is important in all of our work, be it truth and reconciliation or education, law, or governance. I'm not proposing that there are such vast cultural differences between people that we don't have the intellectual bridges to cross them. I don't think there's much mileage in creating dichotomies. But we still have to be culturally and geographically specific in our work and the way we think about people. The next ethical challenge concerns power. And power, as we know, power and power dynamics are a part of every single relationship. It only happens inside relationships. It doesn't happen outside. So there are many types of power coming from education, coming from economic status, from our professions, our personality, age, gender, family connections, or class. These are currencies of power that they're at play all the time between us and around us. There are also different types of powerlessness, and they range from not getting your own way to your existence not mattering in the universe. the relationship between the commissioners and the people who appear before it is a power relationship. It has its own power dynamics. When we tell someone else something that's important to us, power is vested in the listener by virtue of the trust that we've placed in them. And recognizing that power and its dynamics is an ethical matter. Whether and how those of us in power continue to hold power is also an ethical matter. So turning now to the question of agency, I'd like to suggest that there's a cognitive dissonance that occurs when we think about victims and when we think about agents, when we try and do that in the same thought. For example, when we think about the 500 missing Aboriginal women in Canada, we tend to think of all Aboriginal women as victims, not as agents who have survived. Can we think about the people who've been hurt in the residential schools as agents with will who have survived? Or will we think of them in perpetuity as victims? What are the consequences of thinking of a people as victimized? One consequence is that we remain defined by our suffering. Another consequence is that we can be disempowered and paralyzed as victims forever. And when this happens, our lives can become entirely dependent on the actions of others. This is an issue for victims of crime, for Aboriginal women, for Aboriginal people generally. My good friend and colleague, Chris Anderson, says that if we think about Aboriginal peoples solely as victims of colonization, then we dishonor all of the ways that our ancestors survived. They were agents of will, as we all must be. Johnny Mack, who is a Toqat legal scholar from Vancouver Island, argues that the self is entirely agentic, embodying power, regardless of how deeply subjected the self is in the hegemonic power relations. We can hear and appreciate the terrible suffering wrought by residential schools, but we also must have expectations of the people who were harmed as agents with responsibilities in their communities. To not see the people as who were harmed as having a responsible future is to dishonor them and their potentiality. Another ethical challenge for the Commission to get past, in order to get past the cognitive dissonance, is to perceive people who appear before them as agents who have been harmed but who have survived. So the bottom line is that suffering doesn't sanction us to cause suffering to others, no matter how terribly we've been hurt. Our suffering needs to be understood as one of the factors that shapes us, but it doesn't excuse our abuse of others. The next ethical challenge, the topic is about substantive change, and this has been raised by a number of the speakers so far. And there have been major criticisms of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa because it didn't include land reform and it didn't include water reform, so that at the end of the day, the power structure still maintained that of the white farmers. So one of the questions now with the commission is, how does the work of this commission, how is it going to matter without the possibility of it creating substantive political, economic, or legal change? And how is the work of the commission going to matter if it's constrained within the limits of the current colonial power structures? So while there's no doubt that there will be good that is going to emerge from this, how will the substantive limitations be explained to those that will appear before it? Will it determine who will appear before it? And the next question is, how will those limitations be explained to the broader public who will have created expectations for Indigenous people as a result of hearing about the Commission? On the topic of politicizing healing, the infliction of political harms Our collective harms, rather, is a political act, and healing from such harms also needs to be understood as a political act. This means that contextualizing the individual differences, that must be contextualized within a broader political frame. And we must understand the injury as a collective injury created by actions in certain political circumstances. This is really hard to do. Despite our best efforts to understand that larger political frame and to look at individual harms within it, we still end up treating the individual as for those individual harms. So if we look at the violence against women, that is political. It's born of a society which has created conditions which support sexism and violence. But when we treat women who have been assaulted, we treat them as individual victims who have been harmed by individual offenders. Martha Minow, who's an American legal scholar, argues against medicalizing political harms. She argues that when you medicalize collective harms about a people, what you do is you decontextualize those acts and you depoliticize the injuries. In Canada, we've medicalized women who've killed their violent spouses out of fear of their own lives by calling it the battered women's syndrome. This is instead of considering that the actions of those women were reasonable in their circumstances. That is a political interpretation. So individualizing the harms, this is a question that runs through, it's a dilemma that runs through all of the restorative justice work, is that do we just obscure the larger power structures and systemic racism and oppression when we just focus on the individual? And we will often do that because we don't know how to deal or think about the collective, the larger picture. And it's easier then to blame the victim. So for the commission, an ethical challenge is to maintain the larger political frame while hearing individual narratives. How can the individual be respected individually but still be understood as part of a collective? And the big question is, can the commission help people to not be trapped in the story that they tell? Can the commission help people to individually and collectively tell another story about themselves? And part of this is recognizing that within our own societies, we have resources within our Indigenous legal traditions. We have resources that we can call on. So it's about not recognizing ourselves as continually being in the deficit. The next concern has to do with politicizing or recognizing the politics of spirituality and ceremony. An ethical challenge before the commission is to recognize that, is to recognize the politics of spirituality and ceremony, because historically those acts of ceremony and spirituality were a part of something larger that gave them meaning. They were embedded within larger systems of a people. And when we start to think about ceremonies as non-political, they're still political acts, just as elders are political beings. We add them to events. We usually do that to try and affirm who we are. I'd like to write a paper one day which is entitled, "Where Are Your Relatives to Slap the Back of Your Head?" In other words, ceremonies had a cultural context. People were accountable to one another for what was said and done in them. And when we remove ceremonies from their cultural context and plant them elsewhere, the ceremony can be reduced to superficiality. On the topic of citizenship, I think that ultimately the work of the commission and all of our combined political work is about building an engaged citizenry with intellectual capacities, both individually and collectively. So how might the work of the commission help to sustain people beyond the mandate of its work? there's a fragile balance between, on the one hand, recognizing the deep pain of suffering, and on the other hand, recognizing agents with responsibilities to ourselves and to our societies as citizens. Before I came here, I visited an elderly friend, and he showed me pictures on the wall of children that were in residential schools where he attended. My friend went through the rows of pictures, and he pointed here and there. He said, this one died of internal injuries, internal bleeding. This one disappeared, and so on. And what I have to remember in my relationship with my friend is that this is one story in his life. There are many other stories that he can tell. And his residential school experience does not determine all of who he is. My final comments are that the Commission has good people with a lot of experience and wisdom that they can offer. The available documents indicate a potential for thoughtfulness about the difficult issues and a recognition of those issues. But I hope that the work of the Commission is really uncomfortable, because what I tell my students is that stay with the discomfort. That's where the real learning happens. And as a final thought, the work of Deborah Dickinson from the United States, who says that if racism ended at midnight tonight, black people would still be constrained within it. I think that that has some lessons that we can draw on as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Val. And it's my pleasure to introduce now Dale Turner. He works at the Government and Native American Studies at Dartmouth University. Did you come here? Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's great to be here back in Mohawk Territory in the city of Montreal. Thank you to the organizers, in particular Martin Blanchard, for facilitating my travel. And it's kind of it's the first time I've ever had simultaneous translation, so it's a little freaky thing to as a philosopher, Note to self: I am not translating. Now. Interestingly, there's some irony to that, as you'll see in my presentation. in this presentation, I will focus on an ethical challenge that this commission, I think, will face. This is the problem of reconciling what the commission will hear from Aboriginal peoples with the language of public policy. I believe the form or forms of reconciliation this commission must seek mirrors the kind of reconciliation that the Supreme Court has laid out in articulating the meaning and content of Section 35 rights. This commission will listen to Aboriginal narratives or explanations of what happened. Perhaps they will be articulated in Aboriginal languages, which creates its own sets of problems that are interesting to explore. But ultimately, the Commission's findings or recommendations must be articulated in a language that is useful to the parties to the settlement agreement through the courts. Now, the overall purpose of the TRC is, and this is in their own words, to guide and inspire First Nations, Inuit and Métis peoples, and all Canadians in a process of truth, healing, and reconciliation that will lead to renewed relations based on mutual understanding and respect. So my discussion will be divided into two parts. In the first part, I'll focus on the meaning and significance of Section 35 of our Canadian Constitution in contemporary Aboriginal politics in Canada. Now, Section 35, as we all have memorized, is that the Aboriginal and treaty rights of the Aboriginal peoples of Canada are hereby recognized and affirmed. And for those of you that don't work in this area, This, of course, came about as from the repatriation of our Constitution in 1982, and the court is nowhere near, not even close, being able to really tell us the meaning and content of Section 35 rights, especially Aboriginal title. It knows next to nothing about what it means to be recognized and affirmed. Yet, of course, given the content and the imperatives that come out of Supreme Court decisions, these sorts of decisions have drastic effects in Aboriginal communities. The Delgamuukw decision, and I'll explain a little bit more about this, the content of this decision in a few minutes, may dictate that Canadian courts need to incorporate Aboriginal understandings into how Section 35 is understood and implemented in Canadian law, but it must do so in a language that is amenable to Canadian law. The optimism of the Delgamuukw decision of 1997 is constrained by what is infamously labeled now as the integral to a distinctive culture test of the 1996 Vanderpeet decision. The reconciliation the court is seeking is possible only within the caveat that whatever Aboriginal peoples have to say about themselves must be subsumed within the political reality of the unquestioned authority of Canadian state sovereignty. Now, in the second part, I will briefly examine the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples and then turn to the mandate of this commission. I believe one reason the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples, a final report, was delayed is because the commissioners wrestled with what I think was a very difficult, if not impossible, task. They had to reconcile what they heard in the 20,000 pages of public hearings with the contemporary language of Aboriginal public policy. And I will conclude by making a few comments why I think this commission must heed these forms of reconciliation, because they have not been resolved in Aboriginal politics in Canada, yet they continue to guide the contemporary legal and political relationship. So, there are three contexts from which we can understand this idea of reconciliation. First, we cannot lose sight of the imperative that the meaning of Section 35 rights represents the reconciliation between Aboriginal systems of law, which predate the formation of the Canadian state, with the unilateral assertion of Crown sovereignty. The second form of reconciliation that seems to have faded in significance over the last 11 years revealed itself when the commissioners had to reconcile the content from the public hearings with the language of public policy. Finally, there are the forms of reconciliation that arise out of this commission's mandate. Once again, a commission is mandated to listen to Aboriginal peoples, but we are by no means clear about how we, meaning all Canadians, are supposed to reconcile this with the existing social, legal, political reality of contemporary Aboriginal politics in Canada. Section 35 rights represent the reconciliation between Aboriginal systems of law, which predate the formation of the Canadian state, with the Crown's unilateral assertion of sovereignty. And to quote from Vanderbeet, what Section 35(1) does is provide the constitutional framework through which the fact that Aboriginals lived on the land in distinctive societies with their own practices, traditions, and cultures is acknowledged and reconciled with the sovereignty of the Crown. The substantive rights which fall within the provision must be defined in light of this purpose. The Aboriginal rights recognized and affirmed by Section 35 must be directed towards the reconciliation of the pre-existence of Aboriginal societies with the sovereignty of the Crown. I'm probably going to repeat this like three or four times because it's to me it's such a driving part of how we should understand Canada's uniqueness with regards to what the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is supposed to do. Aboriginal rights are, by nature, sui generis. This is written into constitutional law. What does that mean, of one kind? How do we then make sense of them? Now, the research and reflections on the meaning and content of Section 35 has a very short 26-year history, which would make one believe that we still have plenty of time to get things right. I used to believe this when I was a graduate student working for the co-directors of research at the Royal Commission, but now I've seen that one Supreme Court decision can cause an enormous amount of damage in Aboriginal communities. What makes a single Supreme Court case even more dangerous is the possibility that the court, guided by the normative language that arises out of the relationship itself, actually got it wrong. It'll take years, if ever, to reconfigure the meaning and content of Section 35 rights down a path that leads to what everyone seems to be labeling a renewed, respectful relationship. I believe that the Vanderpeet decision has precisely accomplished this task of sending Aboriginal rights discourse down the path to what Marlene Castellana once playfully referred to as a philosophical buffalo jump. Now, the infamous, especially for Aboriginal peoples, integral to a distinctive culture test of the 1996 Vanderpeet decision states, excuse me, to be an Aboriginal right, an activity must be an element of a practice, custom, or tradition integral to the distinctive culture of the Aboriginal group claiming the right. A number of factors must be considered in applying the integral to a distinctive culture test. The court must take into account the perspective of Aboriginal peoples, but that perspective must be framed in terms cognizable to the Canadian legal and constitutional structure. Now, there are two problems among many, but two with this approach to characterizing the meaning and content of Aboriginal rights. First, there are the problems with attaching the discourse of Aboriginal rights to normative legal interpretations of Aboriginal culture. The Supreme Court embraces a view of culture that fails to allow for the evolution of Aboriginal cultures beyond seeing them as essentially frozen in time before contact with European cultures. Now, I realize that there are recent decisions that attempt to move beyond this narrow view. However, the point I'm making is that with this approach, Aboriginal rights flow out of the language of culture and not of nationhood. This is a really significant point from an Aboriginal perspective. Most Aboriginal sovereigntists are those that will argue that we have not given up our rights, we have not given up the ownership of our territories, are going to argue that the legitimacy of those forms of ownership flow out of the fact that they have been there for time immemorial, or however long they want to characterize it, and that the source of that of the normative explanations arises out of their own ways of understanding the world. Now, I'm actually more interested in the second problem, where the court states that the court must take into account the perspective of Aboriginal peoples, but that perspective must be framed in terms cognizable to the Canadian legal and constitutional framework. Now, a few paragraphs later, the court says that it is crucial to be sensitive to the Aboriginal perspective itself on the meaning of rights at stake. It must also be recognized, however, that that perspective must be framed in terms cognizable to the Canadian legal constitutional structure. As has already been noted, one of the fundamental purposes of Section 35 is the reconciliation of the pre-existence of distinctive Aboriginal societies with the assertion of Crown sovereignty. Courts adjudicating Aboriginal rights claims must therefore be sensitive to the Aboriginal perspective, but they must also be aware that that Aboriginal rights exist within the general legal system of Canada. Now, this imperative was important for the Dalgamuk decision, which followed a year later. Now, the Dalgamuk decision, which, just briefly, as the Supreme Court decision came out in 1997, December 11th, 1997, and it involved the Gitxsan Wet'suwet'en people in British Columbia, and they argued, at least initially, that they had not given up ownership to their territories and were seeking recognition, and at least initially seeking recognition of ownership. What's interesting about this case, though, is the two-row, to use a Mohawk metaphor, two-row approach that they took to arguing for their case in court. One was to use the sorts of discourses of the state to to use Section 88 of the Indian Act, to interpret certain interpretations of Section 9124 of the Constitution, and the Royal Proclamation of 1763, very much in the discourse of the state of law, of law. On the other side, though, they decided, you know, we're going to tell it the way we see it, the way we understand it. And that just to read a quote at the beginning of the Supreme Court decision, at trial, the appellant's claim was based on their historical use and ownership of one or more of the territories. In addition, the Gitxsan houses have an adok, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, which is a collection of sacred oral traditions about their ancestors, histories, and territories. The Wet'suwet'en each have a kungax, which is a spiritual song or dance or performance which ties them to their land. Both of these were entered as evidence on behalf of the appellants. The most significant evidence of spiritual connection between the houses and their territory was a feast hall where Gitxsan and Wet'suwet'en people tell and retell their stories and identify their territories to remind themselves of the sacred connection that they have with their lands. The feast has a ceremonial purpose, but is also used for making important decisions. Now, Val had mentioned this politics of spirituality and ceremony, and this, I think, is a very good example, because what the court said was that, well, the Canadian courts need to find ways to accommodate the oral histories as legitimate sources of evidence. That was seen on a, if it was just that, that was seen as a victory. That was a very important step that the court was taking in recognizing the legitimacy of Aboriginal ways of understanding the world. However, as I said, and as I've said several times now, that how they articulate the meaning and content of these ceremonies or spiritual traditions, or just the concept of spirituality itself. Spirituality is a term that I'm using in English here to characterize really what is a kind of almost a phenomenological relationship that Aboriginal peoples have in their day-to-day lives. That, in the living the day-to-day of their lives, that's what constitutes this normative dimension that I'm pointing towards, that somehow needs to be brought out of the community, out of the lands, into something like a Canadian court. And one of the things that I'm interested in my work is how do we do that? How do we do that justly in looking at the relationship between people who live in the communities and live their day-to-day lives in the communities and those that end up arguing, presenting arguments for them, whether you're native or non-native, in Canadian courts of law. So this was seen as a victory, however, it was immediately tempered by the constraint of the Vanderpeet, which says, well, yes, we can listen to what you have to say, but you need to articulate it in the language of law. The reconciliation between Aboriginal explanations and the assertion of Crown sovereignty is set up in a way that Aboriginal understandings and explanations will always be trumped by the unquestioned sovereignty of the Canadian state. Section 35 rights represent a constitutional reconciliation between Aboriginal systems of law with the unilateral assertion of Canadian sovereignty. But this assertion of sovereignty embedded in its Canadian and legal constitutional structure has shown itself time and time again to be hostile to Aboriginal understandings of their relationships to their homelands. In many ways, this is how many Aboriginal peoples understand the relationship. Our ways of being simply don't measure up. The Kungaks and Adok are central to Aboriginal explanations of ownership because of their spiritual importance. These spiritual relationships have political significance. How we make sense of these explanations within Aboriginal philosophies is indeed a difficult problem. How we ought to use them in a court of law is quite a different matter. The onus has been on Aboriginal peoples to find explanations that can be subsumed within a system of law that gains its legitimacy with the creation of the Canadian state. Contemporary Aboriginal politics has not moved past the colonial constraints of Vanderpeet. If anything, the relationship has moved in a direction that does not have to give serious consideration to the ways that Aboriginal peoples understand themselves. Reconciliation, at least where an understanding of reconciliation involves the consent of Aboriginal peoples, is not possible as long as Aboriginal legal and political thought remains marginalized in the normative conversations about the meaning and content of Section 35. Is Section 35 flexible enough to evolve in ways to welcome these explanations? This is not a trivial question, and I don't believe the meaning of the question itself is fully understood. Let me move on to the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples. Now, the life of the Royal Commission evolved in a very troubling way, and I see this commission being faced with a similar dilemma. Now, first, remember that the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples was the political fallout from the so-called OCA crisis. Now, many of us older folk remember the rock-throwing incident showing up on newscasts all over the world. The commission came to life as the result of a very confrontational political conflict. But I do remember the commission, for the most part, being met with great optimism. And the commission's life was broken up broadly into two stages. In the first part, there was this massive listening exercise where the commissioners broke up into groups and they went to various parts of all over Canada and they listened to what Aboriginal peoples had to say. And Aboriginal peoples were very optimistic that something was finally going to be done and participated in this as I've read through a lot of these hearings. Now, and I also remember, because I worked at the Royal Commission, it was actually the best job I ever had now that I think about it. My job was, I worked for David Hawkes and Marlene Castellano, and my only job was to read all of the incoming research and to provide short summaries for the co-directors so that they could, you know, make comments to the readers. So I was always reading all of this research. So I always had a big pile of papers on my desk and big cup of coffee. It's where I started drinking coffee. the problem, though, was moving from this stage where they went through this giant listening exercise, which this commission is going to do as well, to having to engage the discourse of Aboriginal public policy in order to make recommendations that were going to be tabled in Parliament. And this is when the commission, I don't know if any of you remember this, but there was a period when the commission was supposed to have its final report out and it was delayed by a couple of years and there were all kinds of, there were internal problems in the commission's life. And I think part of it was that I think the commissioners were profoundly affected by what they heard from the communities, from mostly Aboriginal people. And their problem was that how do they take what they had heard and reconcile it with this language of public policy? And even in terms of the space itself, the commission, where there were a lot of Aboriginal people working there during the hearings and during this gathering of research and the public dimension of it, then when it switched to the policy side of it, a lot of the Aboriginal people disappeared, and I noticed there are a lot more suits walking the halls in Ottawa. The whole tone of the commission changed because now the focus was on public policy. And most of the Aboriginal peoples that participated in that first part were not experts in public policy. In fact, even if you look at the makeup of the commission itself, that several of the commissioners were more activists than they were legal scholars. And yet, on the non-native side, we had a former Supreme Court justice, a law professor, two law professors, no, and a Superior Court justice from Quebec. So this switch in language, oh, go away. Is that a 5 or a 50? Start talking about the commission again. It's like, whoa, don't get me going. anyway, I think that that was a real existential dilemma, I think, for the commissioners and for the commission itself in terms of producing a final report. Now, it's interesting to point out that when the final report was tabled in Parliament, it was shelved immediately for a year. Nothing happened to it. I remember, you know, we had the big celebration in Ottawa, and they, you know, it was on the news, and I actually got on camera because I went like this to David Hawkes. And, now, the government responded to the final report ultimately by producing the apology for the treatment of Aboriginal school children in residential schools. So, in a way, this commission really is following on the heels of the other commission, except that it should be noted that we have 20,000 pages of Aboriginal testimony already on file. I went to the archives in Ottawa. There are 200 feet of archives from the commission. And I don't know, how many of you have read the final report? How many of you have read the public hearings? I mean, this is useful information, but we're not made to see it that way, right? It's just part of an archive. It's like they got it over with in the first part. Now let's go on and do the real work, which is how does this affect, you know, the public policy? I see this commission's mandate being faced with a similar dilemma. This commission will end up with a huge archive, and what to do with it is a serious problem that we need to think about now before we actually set out to gather this information. I can see two directions that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission can take. The first is so that we never again speak of the subject that Cynthia mentioned this morning or in her cartoon. What is being heard, laid out before us, is used to level a historical playing field in order to embed a post-reconciliation relationship grounded in Vanderpeet understandings of Section 35. Further appeals for justice, then, to the unjust historical past are dissolved by the state's genuine commitment, renewing the relationship in this forward-looking way. And hopefully during the discussion we can talk about this. Or what is being heard becomes part of an ongoing process that serves to explain the legitimacy of Aboriginal ways of understanding the world. Now, this is to take seriously the notion that Aboriginal rights are sui generis in nature. It shows not only what happened to Aboriginal peoples and points towards what was lost, but how these narratives are understood by Aboriginal peoples themselves. These narratives can help show what still survives. In other words, these narratives are of philosophical and political value and therefore ought to participate in ongoing dialogues over the meaning of Aboriginal rights, sovereignty, and nationhood. Now, if the relationship is to be renewed based on mutual understanding and respect, those are the TRC's words, then what is heard, like what was heard in the Vanderpeet and Delgamuukw cases and in the voluminous work of the Royal Commission, must be contextualized in ways that empowers Aboriginal communities. What we mean by empowerment is also a contested term. Section 35 needs to evolve and focus not only on how we ought to understand Aboriginal societies before the creation of the Canadian state, but also how this process reveals ways of thinking about Aboriginal peoples that makes the sanctity of the Canadian state's unilateral assertion of sovereignty off limits in legal and political discussions of the meaning and content of Section 35. Thank you.